Welcome back to Hot in the Podcast. And Talking Tokyo was a great series. We loved it. But it is over, Talking Tokyo, because Tokyo is over. Of course, the games may be over, hockey may be over, but the stories are not. And one of the great stories that came from this past Tokyo Olympic Games was the story of Rossi Peterson, the SA hockey men, going out and beating Germany. Of course, Rossi subsequently announced at the end of the Canada game that he is done, although he kind of told us that a little bit beforehand. So joining us today to talk all things hockey and all things hockey podcast. See, thank you for joining us again. It's just tiring here. Derek is on holiday. You may have thought that, but with all the guys on Talking Tokyo, we gave Derek some time off. He's gone to the bush. No stranger to Hockey the Podcast. Of course, you were with us all the way back in episode 34. You're now back for episode 95. But Rossi, you come back as a two-time Olympian, technically speaking, a three-time Olympian. And you come back with a victory against the one of the top sides in the world, Germany. I mean, how was your Tokyo experience?
How's it, Ty? Yeah, nice to be back on the podcast. Jeez, 95 episodes already, so well done. We just got home this week, so I think everything is just still sinking in of, you know, what we've achieved and, you know, what has gone well and, you know, what didn't go so well on that side. But yeah, I mean, after the Germany victory, I mean, that I'm sure you all saw after the game what it meant to us and meant to the team. And it was just wonderful to get the messages back from home and to see what it meant for the South African hockey community. So yeah, that was a big win for us. Yeah. And it was definitely one of the highlights of Tokyo.
Yeah. I mean, it was a highlight of Tokyo, but it wasn't something that was surprising. I mean, you guys went into the games and although you targeted potentially the Great Britain game and had a disappointing result there. There was a clear belief that you were going to get something. And we saw it in the Netherlands game. We saw it in the Belgium game. But it culminated into that German game. I mean, Russ, you've been to the Olympics. You went in 2008 as the reserve keeper. You didn't obviously play then. So technically speaking, you're not an Olympian from then. But you've been there in 2012. 2021 was very, very different from your previous experiences.
Yeah, I think every Olympics has got its special memories and its special times. I also, you know, I went through different phases in my career, and we also had, you know, obviously different coaches, different personnel over those times. You know, in 2008, I went as a youngster, as a reserve goalkeeper. For me, it was just like, you know, it was an amazing experience, you know, off the field and just realizing actually what the Olympics is all about. You know, and learning as much as I could at that stage. I mean, Chris Hibbert was our number one goalkeeper, and I tried to learn as much as possible from him. So that was that phase. And then 2012, you know, when I got picked as the number one, you know, we had a really good team, a really experienced team. You know, Clark had his work cut out for what we wanted to achieve in London. In London, in so many games, we got so close. But, you know, if you go back, you know, we got very, very close against Spain. You know, we went into the change room against Pakistan with a 2-2 draw, and we just lost the game in the end. And even against Argentina, you know, we went 2-0 up, and then unfortunately lost the game. So, and then the only results basically we had there was a draw against Great Britain. And then, you know, for 11 and 12 playoff, we beat India 3-2, which was nice at the end of the tournament. You know, but after London Olympics, I think for me personally, it sunk in that it felt like, you know, SA Hockey and the SA men's team still had some unfinished business. Of course, you know, we were not sent to Rio Olympics. So that was not the calling. So, you know, the 2020 or the 2021 Olympic Games was personally for me, a big, a big, big thing to go to Olympics and to show, you know, what this SA Hockey men's team's got and, you know, what we have to offer with the talent that we have in South Africa. So, you know, different phases throughout the Olympics. But coming back now, you know, actually realizing we had our eyes to get into a quarterfinal. I think people didn't realize we didn't play, you know, against a top 10 nation for more than 500 days. We had a proper program lined up. I mean, in January, before the Olympics, you know, we had the Belgians that were supposed to come out. India was supposed to come out, the Netherlands, Canada. And unfortunately, with COVID, you know, when South Africa got red flag, you know, all of those tournaments got cancelled. So we had to do with what we had. You know, we were fortunate that our neighbors came over from Namibia and we could play 5 test matches against them. You know, and all due respect to them, they gave us a good run for our money in one of the games, but you know, you want to play one of these top nations. So it was a little bit of a tricky one. We knew, you know, we could only do the best with what we had. We had 2 proper training camps in Poch where the guys really pushed themselves. The coaching staff has really, you know, came up with a good plan and the circumstances we got. We couldn't travel. You know, no teams could come here. You know, we were also supposed to go to Malaysia, and then all of a sudden, just before we wanted to leave, they said, well, we got 14 days quarantine there. They just went to lockdown, so we had to cancel that. So, you know, with the talent that we showed in Tokyo, we knew as a team, you know, what we got. For us, you know, going out there, you know, and going into halftime against Great Britain in the first game, I think the score was 1-1 at that stage. You know, we were a little bit peed off. We wanted to have at least 1 or 2 up in them. For a lot of people, it was a surprise. For us, it wasn't a surprise at all. You know, we went into the Olympics and we worked out that we needed, you know, Coach Ewing called it, you know, Project One. He wanted to make sure we get a result, you know, maybe out of GB or against the Germans. And then, you know, Project Two was to make sure that we beat Canada to get 6 points in our pool and, you know, and then advance to the quarterfinals. So, you know, eventually it worked out that, you know, 7 points wouldn't have been enough. I think, you know, everybody that watched the game against Great Britain, you know, knew the second half. I must say we threw it away a little bit with ill discipline where we had too many cards. I think for the whole half, we played with a man down. And we just couldn't chase the game at that stage. You know, and then going to the Dutch game, I think, you know, going 3-0 up so early in the game, I think everybody was surprised. You know, even we were surprised, but it just felt like, you know, there was more goals left out in that game. You know, unfortunately, we came out losing 5-3, but also giving a lot of credit to the Dutch keeper, Pierman Blaak. I think he had an amazing second half. We really tested him. And he just, you know, he just, I mean, he's a royal goalkeeper, you know, and he just stepped up to the plate. You know, against Belgium, you know, we got it very, very wrong defensively. You know, we caught a bit of a hiding, but there was phases in the game. I think at one stage we were 7-4 down and we were still scoring goals. And I mean, there, I think the guys showed what fighting spirit this team has got. You know, so going to the German game, you know, beating them 4-3, it wasn't really a fluke for us. You know, we really had our plans, you know, worked out. And throughout the camps, we said, you know, this is how we want to beat Great Britain, or this is how we want to get a result against Germany. This is how we're going to beat, you know, Canada. We had all these plans. So it was just on the day. And I mean, the Olympic shows on the day, if things may click, you know, you'll win. And it doesn't matter what sporting code. And I think that's what the beauty is about the Olympics. You know, you only have one chance. Unfortunately, we came off the field that day with a 4-3 victory. But like I say, it just came from hard work, you know, having such talented group of players in South Africa, you know, and having Gareth Ewing just coming up with these game plans and just saying, guys, you know, here's the framework, but go express yourself. I want you guys to go play hockey. I don't want you guys to be robots. And I think that's what we showed there at the end of the day. And that's, I think, what made this Tokyo Olympics so great for the kind of hockey that we played.
Russ, let's go back to the Great Britain game. We had that, that second half of poor discipline. What do you put that to? Is it down to the fact that we hadn't played enough hockey? Is it down to lack of experience at major events? Because remember, South Africa on average 60 caps, Great Britain almost 150. Was it down to a mentality thing? Was it down to just players that need to back up? What do you think it was down to?
Yeah, you know, it can go down to a lot of things. I mean, we have to own up to that. You know, like I say, the guys that got the cards, you know, after the game, maybe there was maybe one harsh card. But I think, you know, it comes down to that we are not playing enough international hockey. So it means we're not getting exposed to, you know, international umpires. I mean, I see, you know, Erasmus was taking out all the referees the other day. And it's like, you know, it doesn't matter if it's rugby or hockey or whatever sport, you know, there's different interpretations. And unfortunately, you know, in club hockey, with all due respect to our umpires, you know, and our local leagues, I think we get away with a lot of crap, to be honest. And I think that was just a lesson learned for us on that day. You know, when you're going to push somebody around, or, you know, when there's going to be, you know, a naughty tackle, you know, there's a lot of cameras that looks, you know, that catches you on the field. So you can't get away with this stuff. And you know, you've got top umpires there that can see the stuff. So I think, you know, bit of, you know, put it down to lack of experience, you know, that for, you know, bit of ill discipline. I mean, we were very disappointed in ourselves after that game. And we just, it was just like a reality check again. It's like, you know, you can't get away with this. And, you know, you have to keep your discipline for 60 minutes in the game. Otherwise, it will hurt you. And that, like I say, that's the biggest lesson we took out of that. And we had to turn around very, very quickly. And the boys just showed it in the next couple of games.
Yeah, and obviously we saw the discipline improved. We obviously 3-0 up against the Netherlands. You had a cracker in that game to really keep us in that big moment. I mean, in Belgium, we had a terrible opening quarter, and we were always up against it, but we didn't back down. We got the German results, and there was definitely the high of the German result, but it was almost scandalous the turnaround time in that heat between the Germany game and the Canada game. I mean, do you feel like we were given not enough opportunity to and not just us, Canada as well, but not enough opportunity to produce as quality a game? Because it was a bit more error-strewn, and you could see it was two teams who, unfortunately, we knew at that stage that even a win wouldn't really have been enough anyway.
Yeah, look, I mean, it was quite a jam-packed schedule. I think we played 5 games in 7 or 8 days. So it was quite heavy on the legs for the guys, I'm sure. And like everybody know, it was bloody hot out there. The German game, I think we played 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And the next day, you know, it was 12 o'clock again. But, I mean, we can't make any excuses, you know. And that Canada game, we had a lot of chances to win the game, and just to close out the game, you know, we went early up 2-0 against in the match. We had some other chances as well. So we can't really blame anybody but ourselves, not closing out that game a little bit earlier. But yet again, you know, I mean, Canada is like, you cannot underestimate that team. You know, that there's a reason why that team is in the top 10 in the world for so long. You know, they're a very experienced bunch. They've got good coaching staff. They've got a really good program. So, you know, we can't take anything away from them. We knew it's not going to be an easy match. It's not going to be a walkover. I mean, especially us, you know, going into the tournament with the lowest rank team there. We knew there's not going to be any easy games for us. But I don't think we can make any excuses. I mean, it is heavy on the legs. But, I mean, it's part of the job. And we knew that's going to be the schedule, you know, many, many months before. So, yeah, I mean, it's the same for both teams out there in the end of the day. Unfortunately, we couldn't get that win, and we just let it slip there, I think, in the last minute of the match. But, you know, to come out with the result, you know, like you say, it was, even if we got the win, you know, a couple of months before the tournament, we thought, okay, well, 6 points will be enough to get through to the quarters. Unfortunately, in the pool, we had Netherlands and Great Britain that drew that match, and then all of a sudden, we couldn't get there. So yeah, I don't think, you know, we're professionals. The boys are fit. So I don't think we can put it down to that. And especially the Canadians. I mean, you know, we would prefer the hot weather against any European team or Canadian team that's coming from the cold.
Great points. I didn't think about that before. Yeah, Russ, obviously, Belgium went on and won it. And Belgium had a South African as the assistant coach in Craig Fulton. They beat Australia, who had Dave Staniforth on the coaching staff. And of course, in bronze medal place was India, whose assistant coach is Greg Clark. So we're seeing a major South African contribution to world hockey. You know, what are we missing out on from these guys?
Yeah, I mean, it just comes down to the point I made earlier, that the talent that we have in South Africa. I mean, we underestimate actually how big the hockey community is, and hockey is, you know, at school level, it is absolutely massive. I mean, if we compare it to other countries, you know, we got a massive, massive junior structure. So it means there's a lot of good hockey players and good hockey coaches that's coming through the structure. Unfortunately, our structure doesn't, you know, after school hockey offers a lot of money for these professionals like these coaches. So unfortunately, we do lose them, and they move on. You know, another name that you didn't mention, he was keeping himself below the radar, a guy, Craig Siebert. He was also one of the assistants for Canada. So he had, you know, not just three South African coaches in the men's set or in the men's pool there, you had four. And these guys, unfortunately, have to move on to greener pastures because I think, you know, there's not just more to offer them from a hockey point of view, but financially. And, you know, having Clarkey in that Indian setup, I think he's done wonders. I mean, he was a guy that gave my first cap, and I've got so much respect for him. I mean, he played over 200 games, I think, for South Africa as a player, and I think he played for 12 years for South Africa. So, and all around the world, and being a coach, you know, Clarkey knows hockey. You know, maybe he didn't always get the results of the SA team that he wanted to. And, you know, he's moved on. I mean, a guy like Craig Fulton, you know, Craig I knew for many, many years because when I started as a junior in Pretoria, you know, he was one of my coaches and one of my mentors. And I think all of them would love still to be part of the South African, you know, coaching staff. And but unfortunately, just from a financial point of view, I mean, we take Gareth Ewing, the guy's not getting a pay. You know, he's a head coach. So the guys are basically volunteers. And I think that's where we just lose these coaches. And again, it just shows these guys are winning medals and they got huge credibility in world hockey.
Russ, the last thing that I want to talk about in terms of on the field as Tokyo is when the game finished in Canada, you were against Canada, you were very emotional. Obviously, we knew that a year before you had already said that the Olympics would be your swan song. Obviously, you had to postpone that. I mean, take us through the emotions of that Canada game, knowing that that was, you know, your final game for the country. I mean, you made the decision. You weren't changing your mind. And it was clear that when the final whistle had gone, you know, you and your teammates knew that that's where you stood.
Yeah, Tyron, yeah, it's you know, it's not just that game. I think it was every single game and every single moment, you know, not just in Tokyo, but the training camps and the building up to that. I think this last year has just been absolutely incredible for me personally. You know, we went into, just before COVID, we went into that German series when they were in South Africa. First, we started with USA. I knew, you know, I told Gareth Ewing, you know, after he took over for Mark Hopkins, I said, listen, if you want me and I'm still good enough to play and you want to pick me, I'm going to give you one more full go. But after the Olympics, I will be done. You know, and the plan was for 2020. And you know, it ended this year, but so every single moment that I had was, you know, I cherished it. Every single training session, you know, I gave it my all and I've enjoyed it so much. I think the last year, what a lot of people don't know, and I think it also comes down to that this big victory over Germany, or, you know, the kind of brand of hockey that we played there and the boys expressing themselves, was in lockdown. You know, this team couldn't do anything besides by sitting at home, you know, and waiting for the training pitches to open for us again. And with our management staff, we had two incredible guys, Craig Carolyn and Ian Shippey, being our two sports psychologists. And all we could do was, like, really, you know, building our team ethos and our team character and where this team wanted to go. And I think we did a lot of soul searching, and I found a lot of stuff about myself and also figured out how much, why we play this game. So it's been a long haul, and you know, going to Tokyo and also realizing, okay, this is your last tournament for your country. You don't always think about it on the day, because obviously it doesn't matter what day or what time it is of your career. You always want to do well for your country when you wear the green and gold. And I think after that, the German game, you know, there was a lot of emotion there already, because it was just like, you know, we worked so hard for this victory. And like I say, it wasn't a fluke. You know, we worked hard for that. You know, and after that Canadian game, you know, when the I remember the goalkeepers, we have a goalkeeper room where they leave, or where we can leave all our kit. And it was actually in the other stadium. And I went to my goalkeeper room, and I had Gowan Jones, which was my backup keeper in Tokyo. And, you know, me and Amber had a nice, how can I say, casual chat. And he also just asked me, how are you feeling? And I said, well, I'm not feeling anything different, you know, to any other game. I just want to go out there and hopefully, you know, we can get this result to South Africa. You know, padding up, I was quite calm. You know, we went into the game. You know, of course, I think any sportsman, you want to end off your career with a win. Unfortunately, we walked off there with a draw. But I think after that game, you know, a lot of emotions just sunk in. And it was just like, you know, seeing all my teammates that becomes part of not just your mates, but family as well. And so many things go through your head, you know, so many memories. Yeah. And it was all just like absolutely happy thoughts. And I said it in my retirement letter or my post, is I honestly can say I retired with a happy heart. You know, hockey has given me so much, and of course it was sad to come to an end. But you know, everything comes to an end. So yeah, it was a little bit emotional, and you know, the messages that I got from my teammates, from people back at home, my family, everybody, it was just so humbling, and people that you don't even realize has been, you know, has been watching you over so many years. I mean, I was just taken back, and it was just so humbling. And like I say, I was just so proud of this team, and that we, you know, maybe we didn't win the medal, maybe we didn't get into the quarterfinal, but we really showed that, you know, we can entertain, and we deserve to be on the world stage. We deserve to be at the Olympics. And I'm sure this team has added, you know, something to the quality of hockey at the Olympic Games. And that was for me a proud moment to say, right, okay, I'm taking off my pads. And, you know, and hopefully SA Hockey or the SA Men's team is in a better spot now. And I think that's all I could wish for. And that's why I say, with a happy heart, I said goodbye that day.
Russ, you obviously have experienced some great places in the world in your career. Obviously, India more than most. But, you know, how did Japan stack up against some of the other places that you have been?
I mean, Japan is an incredible place. And I think what makes the place is definitely the people. I mean, all the athletes you see at the end of the Olympics, they say, okay, thank you very much. Olympics was great. Thanks for all the sponsors. Thanks for everybody. But you can see there, every single athlete talks about the volunteers. And I think the people just make Japan so special. Even with the Rugby World Cup, you know, if you look at all the stadiums were packed, the Japanese people, a lot of those Japanese probably didn't even know what rugby is. But they cheer on, doesn't matter who's playing on the day. And I think for me, it is just like every day or every match when we got off the bus, you know, usually you got the camera guy following you to the change room, but there was just a tunnel of Japanese people, volunteers, just applauding us all the way into the change room. You know, and when we got into the change room, everything was 100% perfect. If you ask somebody for something that you needed or maybe some kind of advice, maybe not all of them could understand English, but they were so helpful and so friendly. And I think that's what makes Japan such a special place. Unfortunately, we couldn't explore Tokyo because we had to stay inside the village. So all we could see of Tokyo was, you know, out of the bus when we were driving to the stadiums. But I mean, from what you could see, it's such a clean place. I mean, it's absolute. Tokyo is a beautiful city. I mean, it's, I never knew there's so much water going through the city. It just felt like we're just going over one bridge and another bridge of just waters and canals. But yeah, I must be honest. You know, in 2012, we were there with a qualifier for London, and a similar experience. We were not in Tokyo, but we were in a smaller town called Gifu. And, Yeah, it's honestly a special place, and I would recommend it to any for anybody to go travel there.
But now, Russ, I mean, here's the thing that a lot of people, they would have heard about it, but not actually understood. This was very different for you guys because, yeah, I mean, with everything going on with COVID, you didn't have the freedom that you possibly would have had at other games. You couldn't really leave the village. I mean, what was, and at least you've got village experience before, but what was the village experience like?
Yeah, I think, your first thing is when you go to the Olympics, your main job is to go perform. So we talk about a lot of the distractions and how we can manage the distractions, because it's so easy to get distracted with a lot of stuff that's happening around you, and you lose focus. And I think that's what I personally learned, one of the lessons when I was in Beijing. When I was a reserve keeper, I was like, it's so easy to get distracted with, go to this event and it's important to go see this. And, you walk into the eating hall and there's a famous sportsman and you want to take a photo with him or her. It's something that you discuss beforehand as well. We had obviously a big part of the group has never been to Olympics, but luckily most of the players went to Commonwealth Games. So they've had a similar kind of experience, what a village is like. We knew it's going to be quite jam-packed. Like I said earlier, there's going to be game after game, back to back. So there's not going to be a lot of time to go explore. We also spoke months before we went to the Olympics that we made a team call that we were not going to go to the opening ceremony because we were playing that big game against Great Britain the next day. So everybody knew more or less what to expect when we get to the village. And also when we got there, I mean, first of all, you're at the airport. I mean, I think we were stuck at the airport for 6 hours because you had to do all your COVID testing or all your different kind of protocols before you could enter the country. And then you had to wait for your bus to take you to the village. So, I mean, I think we landed in Japan. I think it was like 10 o'clock in the evening after a very, very long, long flight. Then we started like COVID testing and all the kind of different protocols, and we only arrived at the village 4 o'clock in the morning. So when we got there, I think we were one of the first athletes actually arriving in the village. So we went straight to the eating hall. The buggers, especially the youngsters, they're always hungry. So we went into the eating hall. We had whatever you would call it, dinner, supper, breakfast. I mean, we didn't know what our biological clocks were doing at that stage. And then we checked in. And then for the first 2 days, you obviously have to acclimatize as quick as possible and also try to get over your jet lag. So that we also planned going before we went to the Olympics. We had a kind of jet lag plan that the medical staff, Doc Shang and the coaching staff has worked out. So there was phases while we were still in Poch where we had to wake up 4 o'clock in the morning and, just to try to get our clocks ready. But the most important thing was is you also have to explore a little bit and enjoy what is going on. And I think where our management staff was quite sharp, Gareth has told the guys, listen, guys, for the first 2 days, we're going to have a training on the second day, but go get all the crap out of your system right now. Go explore the village, go look at all the shops, go to see where every single corner of the village is, go check where all the other countries are, get that crap out of your system. And in 2 days' time, then it means it's business time. So I think that was quite important. The village itself, I must be honest, was unbelievable. The village felt a little bit smaller than London, but I just think it's because the buildings were much higher. So we had in our tower, we had the Cuban team staying in there. We had Norway was in our tower. We also had the Indian team there, and we had the Irish that I could see. And then right across from us, we had our friendly, well, our friends from Australia. 20 meters away, and then across from them you had USA, you had Great Britain, then you had on the other side of the road you had the Italian team sharing with the Argentinian team, so it was all quite close to each other. So it was quite, in a way, I must say, quite festive. There was obviously lots of protocol rules. You had to wear your mask all the time. We had to do COVID testing every single morning. You had to keep your social distance. Even inside the eating hall, you had your you know, when you were sitting at the at a table, there was this kind of screen. So you walked in, you would have put on your plastic gloves, you would sanitize, of course, and then you can dish up. And then when you go sit at your table, you sit behind these see-through covers. It reminded me, you know, back in the day when you were writing exam and you were sitting very close to your mates, but those ones were not see-through. And then, yeah, so then, like I say, it was a little bit, I can say in one way, it's a bad thing because you would like to go watch the other events and you couldn't. But also on the other side, you know, with our program, there wasn't time to really go watch some of the other events. We did drive past some of the stadiums and saw one or two of the stadiums. And then when we were finished after that last game against Canada, you know, we, being South Africans, we thought, you know, bugger this, we're going to slip into one of the stadiums. And we just got on one of the athletes' buses and we went to go watch a bit of athletics, dressed up as track and field athletes. So we did get a bit of a glimpse of the athletic track. But all in all, I mean, the village was just unbelievable. I mean, they've got a proper eating hall there, as big as a pick and pay, you can say. They got a clinic there. So if you needed a dentist, if you needed stitches, if you needed anything, physio or anything, you could have had it, was by hand there. And then, yeah, and then I think at the end, there was a big area, big grass area. I mean, the village, for the people that didn't see on TV, it was right on the water. There was a big grass area with a big park where I think a lot of the athletes, when they were finished and waiting for their flights, because you had 48 hours before you had to fly out or leave the village, a lot of the athletes will get together there and, you know, have a cold one together, you know, obviously in a safe kind of way. Some of the South American teams will get very, very festive and they bring their loud music until the volunteers or the security tells them to bugger off. But yeah, in a nutshell, the village was really excellent. I mean, the food was brilliant. You could have any dish from Japanese food, Asian food. There was a big halal counter, a grill counter. So yeah, all in all, I must say, first class.
All right, Rassie, but what the listeners all want is, they say what happens in the village stays in the village. What's something that happened in the village that you can tell us that people wouldn't necessarily know?
Listen, there's no doubt about it. I think it does, you know, when the athletes finish their events, it does get a little bit loose. I'm not going to go into much detail. I don't think there was any looseness, you know, in our crowd. But yeah, you do hear some stories. You know, you see some all of a sudden, you know, off. I mean, when we were finished, the Canada game, like we said, was midday on the Friday. And all of a sudden, you have the Friday night, you have the whole Saturday, and we only flew out on the Sunday night. So you did see the boys, you know, all of a sudden disappearing ones and twos. So I'm not too sure what they got up to. Well, maybe I know, but you keep that. But like you say, well, what goes on Twitter goes on Facebook. So go have a look for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not like any of them fiancés were playing for Netherlands or anything like that.
Yes, well, so some may say, you know, Timmy, well, I didn't want to mention names, but we know old Timmy's better half, the gold medalist Ava de Goede, but he did tell me once or twice, listen, I've got a meeting now with the coach, and if I ask him where's the meeting, he said no, all the way at the eating hall. So then I didn't ask more questions after that.
Yeah, I mean, look, Russ, the other thing is through your career, and I brought up Netherlands because I know a very, very good relationship the South African men have had with the Dutch for years, very respectful of one another, and I know you got some really nice messages, but across the globe, I mean, you know, who ranks up in your list of friends? Which countries have you really developed soft spots for? And, you know, if you had to represent another country, which one would be tugging at the heartstrings?
Yeah, look, I would never, ever want to represent another country besides South Africa. But you do really make some good friends, you know, over the years. For me, it's like, you know, I think that the Dutch, they're very similar to us. They're quite festive and they're quite serious about their business, what they, you know, what they want to do. So I think there's always been a kind of connection there. Obviously, it is very obvious with the women, like I mentioned, Timmy Drummond, and maybe one more guy. But I think all in all, it's like, you know, especially for some of our players when they go play overseas. So I just saw like old Dan Bell, you know, he plays his hockey in Belgium. So, you know, he's made a lot of Belgium mates, and not just Belgium mates, you know, one or two Argentinian players are at his club as well. So you see, he's maybe got a special bond a little bit there with the Belgiumies or with some of the Argentinian guys. But yeah, I must be honest, it was nice to see while we were there how many messages I personally and some of the other guys I'm sure also got from our African friends, like especially from our Namibian community. You know, we got a lot of messages from them and saying we're rooting for you guys, we're backing you guys, and some of the other countries. So that was also special to see. You know, it wasn't just us representing South Africa, but it also felt like we were representing our continent, which was awesome to hear and awesome to see.
And Russ, which fellow hockey athletes could compete most gainfully against the South Africans at a boat race?
At a boat race, I would love to take on the bloody Aussies with their big mouths. I saw the last night on a little write up there, they caught five of the Aussie hockey boys that slipped up at 3 a.m. to go buy beer to bring into the village. I think we were one or two ahead on them, but I'm not going to mention too many details or say too much. But I would love to, yeah, I would love to get them in a boat race. And good luck for whatever country wants to go against us as a boat race.
Yeah, good old hockey fan sessions. I can only imagine how good we could be. Russ, I mean, the other thing is... now life continues for you. It's life off the hockey field. Hockey has always been the focus, although you've been busy with business and everything else. You know, what happens now? What's going to be keeping you busy now that you're not playing and chasing the rings around the world?
Hopefully my golf handicap will improve a little bit. That's the first thing. But on a serious note, even though I called my retirement a year or 2 years ago that I knew I was going to retire, I still want to give myself just a little bit of time. I'm still going to jog out for the Mighty Wanderers team in a couple of weekends time because now club hockey is back, and I'll definitely play IPT this year. So I still want to play, you know, local hockey. Hence I said, you know, I'm retiring from international hockey. I want to spend a bit of more time with family and my girls. That's very important for me at this stage. All my loved ones has given me so much time away, and I want to catch up a little bit on some my old friendships and spend a bit of more quality time on that I've missed for so long. I'm definitely sure that you'll see me around the hockey pitches still for many, many years. Hockey has given me so much, so many great memories, so many great friends that I would love to still give back to hockey. So in any kind of way or format, hopefully, you know, I'll stay involved. I love this men's team so much. Hopefully, you know, in the future, I can still add a bit of value, maybe a bit of advice or help on the goalkeeper side a little bit. It's just so many things that go through my head. But the main thing is I'll always stay involved in hockey. I love the sport so much. And like I say, it's given me so much over the last, 15 or 20 years that I'll always give back and always be part of this hockey community.
Yeah, and Russ, obviously you've already put your money where your mouth is, quite literally, because you are the national kit sponsor. TK took over, the elephants are back. Must be a large element of pride, obviously, not at the Olympics, but to see the national team in the TK kit must bring you personally a great level of pride.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's proud. I'm very proud to see, you know, when when my brand is stuck on my other brand and the brand that I love so much, or both brands that I love so much. So yes, I think, you know, in COVID, you know, the business has been very, very tough for everybody in the sport industry. And, you know, when we signed a deal, I think a lot of people in my office asked me, you know, you're obviously not doing this with your head, you're doing this with your heart. But I, yes, definitely first with my heart, but definitely also my head. I know what these two national teams has got. I know what product these two national teams, the SA men and the SA women, can put out there. And that, then I'm not even touching about our great juniors that's coming through at the moment. So, yeah, we're definitely proud having the elephants on the shirts, you know, and hopefully people will like the kit and the, all the players will like the kit, and hopefully we'll see the kit on the podium soon.
And Russ, I mean, another thing that you were very, I mean, you and I spoke, you know, behind the scenes that you were very keen on was making kits available for supporters. And obviously you've seen that available on tksportssa.co.za. You can get yourself the pink goalkeeper kit. You can get the green kit. You can get a jumper, a jersey, which I actually wore playing golf today. You know, that was a big part of your focus. And is that something that TK will be doing more of as you offer more options in the future?
No, for sure. I think, you know, it is something that I think we've lacked for so long, and SA hockey is like, you know, our supporters, they crave, you know, to you know, have something, you know, to show that they're part of this team, that they're supporting this team. And, you know, for me, it was an absolute no-brainer. You know, not just a business decision. Yes, I mean, that's where, you know, from a business point of view, you want to try to make some of your money back out of your sponsorship. But it's more just seeing our people not just wearing a Springbok jersey or not just wearing a Proteas cricket shirt or Bafana jersey, but also seeing, you know, people walking proudly with their SA hockey shirt, and on the weekends or when we are playing in tournaments, you know, seeing the community, you know, supporting us, but actually wearing, you know, the badge on their chest and supporting the team, you know, that they love so much. So yes, I think that's a big drive for us. And I think the hockey community has cried out for so long for something like that. So yeah, that was an absolute no brainer for us. And definitely we're going to build out on the merchandise, and then people will see soon there will be more merchandise available. At this stage, you know, it's not in the stores yet, but it's available online. Already we've got support from Takealot that has taken a whole lot of replica shirts. It's available on Takealot. Planet Hockey has taken a whole lot of shirts. And then, of course, like you said, on the TK website or on the TK online store, tksportssa.co.za, all those items are available. So yes, I think it is something that we owe to the hockey community, that we owe to our supporters. And yes, we're definitely going to keep on driving that.
Yeah, it is fantastic. Of course, we also have the Semenya kits that I have and my son has. And, you know, it's great. I've always said, you know, one of the dreams that I had back when I first started All Things Jabu, All Things Jabu. You know, that I started back in 2010 and hockey, sports 24/7, hockey 24/7, before we eventually landed on Hockey the Magazine and Hockey the Podcast. Was that something I want? I want kids to go around and wear the shirt of a hero. You know, the way when the Springboks play, you see everybody wearing green. I mean, on Saturday morning, both my boys and myself, we were wearing our Springbok jerseys as the Springboks were going to play. And it's the same I want for the hockey. When the hockey guys are playing, I want to see people out having bras and getting together to watch us. And yeah, sure, we're not at rugby level, but it's a big step in the right direction for me. So well done to you and TK. One of the things that a lot of people have spoken about post Tokyo is the need for our players to go play overseas. Rush, you played overseas a little bit, but you've spent the last couple of years here in South Africa, obviously, because of business and stuff. I mean, how important do you think it is that the guys get over there and play?
Yeah, Tyron, at the moment, it's so important, especially for our younger players. Because, you know, unfortunately, our club structure and our club leagues, with all due respect again, you know, the hockey is not, it's not the quality that, that a top hockey player, you know, needs at this stage. And I really hope, and I know there's been a lot of talk behind the scenes that, you know, they want to bring, you know, proper structures into South Africa. And we all know that that costs money. But for now, you know, the getting our boys into the top leagues is very, very important. You know, it's nice to see after this Olympics, a lot of our boys, you know, a lot of clubs has been reaching out now to the guys, giving them some offers, you know, especially the German league, the Bundesliga is an excellent league. You know, every weekend back to back, you're going to have a top match, you know, very, very close to international level, because so many international stars are playing in these leagues. You know, we all know the Dutch league is the Playboy league. In the 12 teams in the Hoofdklasse, in every single team, you'll find some international stars in that team. You know, in the Dutch, you know, the Dutch hockey is a lifestyle. So you see a lot of Dutch talent coming through there. Then, of course, we've seen over the years, the Belgium league just getting stronger and stronger. And then also, you know, not taking anything away, but the league in the UK as well. So for the youngsters, you know, SA Hockey will probably be angry what I'm saying is, but for me as a youngster, it is so important if you want to, you know, play top hockey in your life one day and play for South Africa, you know, you need to try to fast track yourself as quick as possible. And the only way you can do that is getting overseas and, you know, go play into these top clubs. But in saying that, you know, sometimes you can have a really bad experience and you go to a different league. I mean, there were stages where we had some of our players playing in, unfortunately, in the wrong countries where it didn't really help their hockey at all, where they went there and saying, okay, well, I'm going overseas to go play international hockey, but the league wasn't good enough. For me, it was, I mean, I played one season in Holland in 2011-2012, and I played in the Hockey India League in 2015. For me, it helped me a lot. I mean, 2011, I mean, that was one of the, I think one of the, like any athlete can have, it was one of my low parts of my career where I got dropped. And I don't know if people can remember, I got dropped in 2011 for Africa Cup. And for me, the only way was, I remember having that chat with Clarkey, who was the coach at that stage, and Mike Bechet, who was the convenience selectors at that stage, behind the old LARPA there at Randburg after IPTN. They said, listen, Bugger, you're not on form. I mean, at that stage, I think I went through that phase where I was a little bit too big for my shoes. I didn't train like I should, and I was just relying on my talent, and I was the number one keeper. And they told me they're going to drop me for Africa Cup. And the first thing that came of mind is like, okay, well, I need to improve myself. And the only way I could improve myself was to reach out to clubs, you know, overseas. And luckily I got the phone call from Bart Loyer. He was the head coach of Skarvader. He was also the Dutch goalkeeper in 2000 when they won the gold medal at Sydney Olympics. And it was a no-brainer for me to go. And that definitely made the difference. I mean, I came back as a much better goalkeeper, much better player. I had a different kind of view of goalkeeping and how I wanted to play my game. I was much sharper, but it also made me a better person and actually realize, you know, what you have to do to be a top player. So yes, I'll definitely say to any youngster, if you get the opportunity, take it, but also make sure that you're going to the right environment, because it can easily happen that you go to the wrong club or you go to the wrong league. So really do your homework first, talk to players that's been there before, talk to some people that's got a bit of business savvy, that you don't sign a contract where you go there and all of a sudden you can't come back for IPT or some other tournaments. That is also important, that you can carry on playing, you know, your hockey for South Africa or for your local IPT teams. That's very important.
Russ, the other thing, and it would be wrong to not ask this, now that you've retired, how frustrating is it that over the 160 odd caps that you earned for South Africa, that we never really got a big sponsor to back the men's program?
Ty, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's, I look at it two ways. And, you know, now after after I retired, you know, I think a little bit automatically think a little bit back in my career, where it all started and, you know, where it all finished. And, you know, the one thing that I don't think people has realized, I think for me, it was clear as daylight after 2012 Olympics, how professional our sport has gone. I mean, you take Argentina, you know, in 2011, we beat them in a bronze medal game in Champs Challenge. In 2012, they went professional. And in 2016, they won a gold medal in Rio. And that's not a fluke. You know, that's just by putting money into the sport. And I think sometimes we have the mentality in South African sport is, you know, they want you to win a medal first or get into the top five in the world first, then you'll get sponsors. And it doesn't work like that. You know, I had a chat many, many years ago to an Olympic swimming coach, and he said, and I actually think it was in the Beijing Olympics where I was just sitting on the bus and I was just chatting to this guy, and he was just saying, you know, at that stage, he told me they were investing $4 million into a medal. And I didn't really understand what he was saying. And he explained to me, he said, well, you know, that $4 million goes into that athlete to make sure that athlete gets what he or she needs to get into the tournaments, to get the right nutrition, to get the best coaches, you know, and maybe this athlete doesn't peak at this Olympics, but the next Olympics, this athlete will, you know, win that gold medal or win a medal. And I think that's a mentality we have. On the other side is, you know, I also think about myself, you know, how much character this team has shown by not always having, you know, a lot of money behind us or sometimes have no money behind us. I take, for instance, my best memories was, you know, when I look at my career and somebody asked me the other day, what was the highlight of your career? Was this German win? At Tokyo, yeah, definitely it was one of my highlights. But I think my highlights always came out of the toughest parts out of my career. You know, the one was in 2012 when we qualified for Olympics, when we won Africa Cup, and the SASCOC told us, sorry, we're not accepting this qualification because they thought the African tournament wasn't good enough. And they gave it to, I think Spain took our qualification. And then we had another opportunity where we could go to Japan to go play in an international level where they said, okay, fine, if you qualify on the world level, then we will send you to London. And at that stage, I mean, we didn't really have a lot of money. And also, I mean, the hockey community jumped in and somehow, I don't know where Clark and them got the bucks. We went to Japan and I'll never, ever forget that final, what the guy showed in the last 20 minutes against Japan. I mean, I remember Thornton McDade scored an early goal where he just scribbled the goalkeeper on the baseline, put it away, and we went 1-0 up. The Japanese came back, and we were 1-1. When we scored a second goal, it was 2-1, and it was that last, I think, 5 minutes where the Japanese pulled off their keeper, and they put on a kicking back, and I just saw this guy in the bib, and they just bombarded us. You know, and I remember making one save after another save, and the guys really get their knuckles on the ground. And it's those memories, you know, luckily we pulled it through and we qualified, those kind of memories, you know, and the next one is going to back to when we had to go to Ismailia in 2017 to go qualify for the World Cup. I mean, the Africa Cup just kept on moving and moving out, because it was in Egypt, and Egypt at that stage was a danger to travel with. There was some unrest there. So we didn't know if we were going to go to Egypt or not. And also, we had no bucks. And at that stage, I think the tournament was in October, and all our European team, all our European players were the European clubs, and the clubs just refused to release the players. At that stage, we also, I don't know if people can remember, we didn't have a coach. So Sheldon Rostron, he had to split himself up in two. You know, he was the ladies' coach at that stage. And then he had to take over the men's team. And I'll never, ever forget, one Sunday he phoned me and he said, listen, I have to have a meeting with you right now. He drove to my house and we sat down. And he said, listen, okay, we need to plan this. We don't have money. We don't have some of our, you know, European players. So we're going to take a young team and we need to plot this out. And he opened his book and there was so much scribbling in his book with players. It was 40 players he was talking about. And we basically came down. He was talking about, you know, who's the guys that you'll take to war with you, because we're going to go to war. And we flew into Ismailia. They kept us under, obviously, you know, how can I say, on a, the accommodation where we stayed, we couldn't go anywhere. We had all these army guys looking after us. And we somehow pulled off that final against Egypt. I mean, again, it was a close score. I think we won 2-1. I'll never forget it. We were 1-1. Well, no, we went 1-0 down very early in the game. Then we equalized. And the Gippos, they were just coming at us. I remember we gave a pass straight to one of their strikers. Fortunately, I got one toe on the ball with a 2-on-1, and the ball just went straight back to the striker off a rebound. And I promise you, my eyes were closed. I just stuck out my hand, and true as Bobby, hit the ball into my hand. And then eventually, you know, we won that game 2-1, and the final whistle went where I saw guys just dropping in our circle where the Egyptian team was bombarding us. And there's those kind of memories that you'll always remember where the team was really fighting in the middle, where they dropped us off in the desert with not a lot of funds, but somehow SA Hockey got us there. That builds so much character, and that actually tells a better story around that. So in the one way, it's like, yes, always been sad that we didn't have a sponsor, but a lot of lessons came through this, and a lot of character has been built by, you know, drinking out of a tap, you know, and always punching above our weight.
Well, you mentioned that. So, Russ, I'm going to ask you if you can pick a couple of games. Obviously, we know the German one, but a couple of games over your career that just stood out for you as making that bigger impact.
Yeah, I think definitely those two games. I just think the magnitude of it is like, you know, qualifying for Olympics or qualifying for World Cup. And then, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of games that stand out. I mean, the first time I won IPT in Joburg, you know, in that final, that's a small thing, but I think for South Africa, it was also in London when we beat India. I think that was quite nice. Also in that same Olympic Games, when we played against Great Britain, you know, in England, in London, you know, in a jam packed crowd, you know, I remember when they were singing the anthems. I mean, this whole stadium just exploded when God Save the Queen played. I mean, it was such a brilliant atmosphere. Unfortunately, we will still talk about that second goal of Great Britain, if it was a goal or not. We drew that game. That was one of them, but, you know, Ty, to be honest, yeah, we all know it wasn't, but we'll leave it there. But, Ty, there's so many great games that I can think about. I remember 2007 also, you know, when we got a result against the Germans, but I don't think it was an official game. It's always nice pipping one of the big teams, but, you know, it's always those qualifiers, especially in those Africa Cup finals. You know, a lot of people don't actually realize how difficult it is to go play hockey in Africa. You know, it is. For me, you know, I always say it's so much easier playing against a European team because you know more or less what to expect. You got quite a bit of video on them. They play more structured hockey, so it's easier to prepare against them. When you go play in Africa, you know, you don't know what you're going to get. And the, you know, the African teams, they're great athletes. They want it as much as you want it. They also want to qualify for the World Cups and Olympics. So there's always those African Cup finals. They're always a tight one against us in Egypt. But also the Kenyans and Ghana has also pushed us in certain games. So you'll always also remember those African Cup finals. It's just because the magnitude of that game for qualifying for these big tournaments. So there are so many. But I remember 2012, Japan, Kaka Megiara, that one stands out. And then definitely that one in 2017 in Ismailia, those two games stand out.
Yeah, we loved them. There's a whole bunch more. I mean, that you played in and you featured in, and obviously as you reflect over the next couple of months, no doubt you'll remember more and more great memories of them. Russ, number 23 is not a normal number for a goalkeeper, but it is the number of Rassie Pedersen. You know, why not number one?
So yeah, it is actually strange. So my first ever jersey that I got was 23, and it's so funny. So when I just started playing hockey, so for people that know, I actually only started playing hockey at the age of 18, and I remember I had this blue jersey. It was actually not even a hockey smock. It was like a proper ice hockey jersey. This blue jersey with this massive 23 on it. You know, and my first, you know, big tour, you know, obviously the club manager or the varsity manager, you know, just said, okay, you're obviously number 23. And he just made me a 23. So, I mean, I just stuck with that number. And then I realized, oh, but Michael Jordan actually stole my number. And then I saw Beckham and Real Madrid also stole my number. So I thought, okay, well, this is then a decent number. And then in 2010, for the first time, I played with a different number in Commonwealth games. So for some reason, Sascock said we could only choose between 1 and 16. So I got the jersey number 1. And it wasn't one of my best tournaments. So that's where I just axed the number 1 jersey and I just stuck with the 23. And yeah, and that's just been my number from day one.
It's absolutely brilliant. Look, my number on a shirt has always been 21, which was easy because they usually selected the first 16 and I wasn't in it. So then 21 was fine. But I got a shirt with number 21 on it once and it stuck.
That's it. But the only downfall is that 23 is not that lucky on the roulette table. That I've also seen over the years. So that's a...
Yeah, look, I like to say that there's deeper meaning. Like 21 is half of the meaning of life, of being 42, and I'm halfway there. But in all honesty, it was a shirt that I was given that had my name and number on the back. And it just became special.
No, it's the same with me. That 23 was just tattooed on me. And yeah, that will always be my number. And and that's how it was.
Including your handicap when we're on the same team in golf, definitely.
Well, this weekend is definitely 36. So yeah, so just tell the boys.
Yeah, there you go. 36 for the front nine. Russ, I mean, obviously, we won't be chatting to you as a national player, but we'll still be chatting to you again in the future as you continue to be involved in the game of hockey. Let's do some quick questions to wrap us off. Let's start with which country made the best food for you over the years?
The best food? Ooh, definitely Argentina. Absolutely love a steak. So, you know, being Afrikaans boy from Rustenburg, I think that's definitely in Argentina and then in Chile as well. Similar kind of grill, similar kind of cows.
Striker with the worst drag flick to defend against?
Jeez, after Tokyo, I would definitely say Mr. Hendricks. But I must be honest, I always had to take a very close look. I always had good stats against Suhail Abbas, funny enough, and I mean he was one of the greatest, but I always had to have a very, very close look at Kumara from Spain. He just had a kind of technique where he got it in the crook and it was so difficult for me to read, so I really had to pay close attention, you know, to him. I must be honest, I remember touring to Argentina, we played 5 test matches against them with a very, very young team. And Mr. Pellat has flicked me one or two balls against the nose where I could feel it. Like, this guy can flick. But, yeah, I would say definitely Kumara, in a way, he probably doesn't know it. But, he was a tricky character for me. And then definitely Hendricks, I think, in the Olympics, he just showed his class. He flicked such a hard ball. He's such a clever flicker. You can see he really does his homework on the goalkeepers, you know, how he executes his plan and just getting goalkeepers off balance, you know, and just putting him into certain spots. It's not, it doesn't always go into the corner, but he puts it in certain kind of spots where he just outthinks the keeper with a lot of disguise and a very quick and hard ball.
Naughtiest roommate you ever had on tour?
Definitely Julian Hikes. Oh, crikey Moses. So, geez, he's going to hate me for telling the story, but I'm going to tell it in any case. So Comm Games 2014. So, for the people that don't know, so Julian Hikes is one of the fittest guys, you know, in our team that I ever knew. Obviously, everybody knew he was one of the fastest guys in the when he was playing as world hockey. But he did have a bad habit once or twice. He would, I don't know if he got too nervous, whatever, but he'll always have somewhere a packet of cigarettes lying around. And I remember in Glasgow, Commonwealth Games, he was my roommate. So he knew and I knew. I mean, we became very, very good friends over the years. We made our debuts together in 2007. So across from us, across from our building, we had the English, the English team staying there, and we also had right obviously there we had the, it was obviously the Rugby Sevens as well. So these boys, they finished their tournament quite early, and of course on the last night they got absolutely plastered in the village, and these guys were drinking and boozing. And what Julian was doing, so every morning he would get up and he'll go to his secret spot, to somewhere in the bushes where he'll have, you know, one or two smokes. And I told him, I said, Julian, this smoking is going to get you into shit, pal. Excuse my French, but those were my words. And he's like, no, it's just one or two for the nerves for a day. And I remember coming back from breakfast and I saw this accreditation hanging on our door handle. And it wasn't my accreditation, it wasn't Julian's accreditation. And I also saw Julian's shoes lying outside the house. And I was like, what the hell is going on? So I'm like, Julian, what is going on? And he's like, he was just shouting in his way and he was so angry. He's like, no, I'm going to go look for this guy. There's one of these English rugby players. I'm like, what do you mean? He says, well, he went to his normal smoking spot and then he could smell something. It's not smelling very, very, you know, normal, and he couldn't bear it anymore. And he actually realized that he was standing in something, the stuff that I told him he's going to get himself into. So literally he got himself into shit. And that was a lesson, but he stole this guy's accreditation because this guy left the accreditation right there. This is how drunk this guy was. And he made sure that he was going to go find this guy and give him a lesson or two.
Brilliant. Yeah. Best fans master.
Best fans master, I must no doubt coach Gareth Ewing. So Gareth Ewing, I mean, you won't say it now, but when I was a youngster, he was one of my coaches and he used to love a jaw when he was still young. But he was absolutely brilliant. And then another guy that I don't know if people can remember, Spider Murray, who also played for South Africa many, many years ago. He was one of the top guys and he had one of these, one of his things in the fines meeting was when he was showing us the Olympics, he could do the Olympics, any kind of event, especially track and field, the javelin throw and fast forward in rewind and in slow-mo. So yeah, definitely those two guys.
Absolute like pivot, the person you would rely on the most to take the final showdown in a shootout.
Yes, definitely one of those two Kasim brothers. I must be honest, these two boys, they back themselves up. I've never seen boys with so much skill, but also so much confidence. Yeah, so I would definitely say those two Kasim brothers, I would back them in any day.
Favorite club to play against?
Yes, let me think. It's always Lekker giving old Eds a bit of a hiding when we play against him. There's always a rivalry because I think, you know, you got your university teams that we always play against, but you know, the Wanderers and the old Eds boys, those are the working class guys, you know, and that plays for a lot of pride on the weekend and obviously for one or two toots afterwards. Yeah, so it's always Lekker to beat old Eds. And yeah, sometimes the JP boys as well.
And toughest club game?
Yeah, I would say, you know, the Varsity youngsters, you know, UJ has always been fit. I mean, Vitz has always been fit. You always have to be smart around them. We always try to beat them with experience, you know, but, you know, that last 10 minutes of the game, it's always tough against those youngsters. But yeah, I would say these little Varsity boykies, I won't say it out loudly to them, but yeah, I think between Vitz and UJ, they've always been tough buggers.
Naughtiest female hockey player in terms of like fans and party animal?
Jen Wilson. So talking about roulette, I remember Jen Wilson. I mean, my first Africa Cup ever, that was in 2007. I think we went to Kenya and Jen was still in the team. And we lived right across the road from what was this place called Safari Park, but Safari Park at a casino. So I remember on the last night after fines meeting, after we won the Africa Cup, Jen Wilson pulled me to a roulette table. She said, listen, boy, let me show you how you play roulette. And we got stuck there for, I think, before the bus left for the next day for our flight.
So Jen Wilson is available. She's no longer the Scotland coach. Maybe she could come back and be a mental or roulette coach for the team.
Yeah, well, I think, we did. Yeah, we did get lucky on the roulette tables that night. That sounds now weird, but we did. We did have lots of fun. But
all right, and the best wingman in the team.
I got to say my roommate, old Tim Drummond. He's an absolute legend. I mean, he's a silent assassin. You won't agree with me with that, but yeah, he is such a champ. I was saying he's the only one that could prove to people that my snoring is not that bad. So for 10 years, he's been my roommate. So yeah, top wingman, Tim Drummond, absolute legend. Great captain, and such a special character in the team, and great mate as well.
And a teammate doesn't have to be national, can be club or provincial. Teammate who's the biggest cell phone addict?
Oh, geez, Tyson. Tyson is by far, I mean, it was, we actually, funny enough, so we were very fortunate to have Cheryl Calder doing our iGym for us. Red Bull sponsored us a full session with Cheryl for the last couple of months for iGym, building up to the Olympics. So the people that don't know what iGym is, it's basically brain, your eyes and brain training. So she's worked with the top teams. When the English won the Rugby World Cup, she was with them, with the Boca, with Ernie Els when he won the Open. So she actually explained to us, screen time, you have to be so careful. She calls it the screen cocaine. It's like if you look into your phone, for too long, it can be very, very bad for your brain and your eyes. And then when the guys started pulling out their phones to look at the screen time, he was by far, I think he actually panicked a little bit. We still don't know what his screen time was because he didn't want to show it to us. And I mean, I've had a lot of screen time at 5 hours, so I don't want to know what his screen time per day was. So definitely Tyson. And I'm sure everybody can see it on social media. What a great lad. He always talks to the hockey community on his social media and he expresses himself. But yeah, no doubt Tyson.
Yeah, I mean, he also did a really nice thing. Calvin Watts obviously been a significant role in his life and he gave him a signed shirt. So, Rossi, I mean, same question for you. Who's that one person you're giving your signed shirt to?
Sure. Look, my mom and my dad, yes, they played such a big role. I mean, they are by far my biggest heroes and they've done so much for me. And, wherever I got in life, if it wasn't for the two of them, I mean, they've just been right there for me, in the good times, the bad times. Sometimes when I needed to get a kick up the butt, they would give it to me. Some wake-up calls, I've just been very, very fortunate having great parents, mentoring me, they've just been always, I mean, it was very sad for them that they couldn't be in Tokyo at my last game. But, I know they were there in heart and, they also got all emotional. When we got back from Tokyo at the airport with a surprise, they were there all in tears. So definitely those two people. I'll give my best jersey, my best smelliest jersey. Hopefully it'll have the smell of victory still on it. But yeah, definitely those two people.
Yeah, so that's Rossi Senior getting Rossi Junior's sweaty Germany jersey. That's going to be amazing. Russ, what about who in the hockey community needs anger management the most?
Ooh, anger management, besides myself at halftime, I would say definitely our grumpy Nick Spooner. I think he's been spending too much time in Germany. So there's definitely we call him the Brett Tucker's given the nickname Bush Pig. So he can moan a lot. Also back in the day, I remember Lloyd Norris-Jones or Chucky had a bit of a temper on him. But I think any bit of a crazy striker has got a bit of a temper on him. But yeah, definitely those two guys. Oh, and I must say, Clark here as well. Greg Clark in 2012 needed anger management. I mean, it was the best seeing Clarky once he walked into the changing room and he just said, "My frustration is the manifestation of the shit that you guys are dishing up." I'll never ever forget that. And myself and Brendan Burtis, we just pissed ourselves in the changing room. Oh, yeah. It was
beautiful. And then, you know, who is the most likely to use a leather wedge on the golf course? You know, just to get a slightly better angle.
Sorry, rephrase that.
Yeah, who's most likely to find every single golf ball that they hit in a round of golf? You know, even if it disappears into the rough, they'll still find it.
Yeah, I would say definitely not that he hits a lot of balls in the rough, but I'll definitely say Tim Drummond. Again, the dark horse there. And then also playing golf with Nick Spooner, you also go look for every single ball. The round also gets longer and longer and longer. And it's usually my ball, not his ball. But yeah.
And then Russ, I mean, you've sung next to a few people, you've sung the national anthem standing next to a bit. You know, who should enter Idols?
Listen, Matthew Goose Brown, hands down. So for the people that don't know, is this guy, he went to Maritzburg College, but he was also in the choir. But listen, I can't remember when was the first time I stood next to him in the anthem. I think it was 2015 or 2016, one of those Africa Cups. And he just started belting Kosi Sikelela out. And I thought to myself, holy crap, this guy, I mean, it was so entertaining just standing next to him. I mean, the next anthem I want to, next match I want to stand next to him too. So now he just started playing the guitar. So he actually had his guitar in Tokyo and in Poch. And he wrote a couple of songs. I don't know to who. I think definitely one or two females in England where he plays his hockey. So if you ever catch Matthew Goose Brown, we begged him to play or to serenade for some girls there at the Olympic Rings in the village some nights. Unfortunately, he didn't get there. But if you ever catch him, ask him to put out his guitar and play some tunes. But definitely, he's the most musical hockey player that I know with quite a nice voice.
And any other players that have hidden talents that we don't know about?
Yeah, Dayan Kassim, not a bad dancer. So if you see him, and also a bit of a proper rapper as well. So if you see him, ask him to do the CPT song for you. That gets us also fired up for some matches in the change room when the boys clap out the CPT.
And yeah, lastly, who, or let's rather ask it like this: what is your ultimate go-to playlist or you know songs before a game?
Yes, it's so weird, eh? It's I mean, I don't often listen to music before a game, but you know, I catch myself, you know, I just think in Tokyo, I listened to a little bit of music on the bus, and then I just went through my playlist. So funny enough, it's like old stuff. Like I like a bit of the Cranberries, and then I get myself with the Fugees, and then like, you know, not to give my age away, but yeah, I'm quite diverse in music, but it keeps on changing. Yeah, I must be honest, but I'm not massive on the music. Besides, when the youngster starts, you know, pulling out the boombox on the bus and they're playing some of the crap that I don't like, then I'll put the headphones in.
And yeah, I mean, Russ, when you're on tour, what is your go-to screen time? Like, what is it? Is it series? Is it movies? Is it Xboxes, nah. WhatsApp?
Yeah, it's never been Xbox. It's never been really series or movies. I never got into that. But I think definitely my work has always kept me busy while I was away. So it'll between WhatsApp and emails that will keep me busy. And then I enjoy a bit of social media, bit of banter between my mates and lads. Yeah, but I think over my hockey career, I've worked right through my hockey career. So work has always kept me a bit of busy. It wasn't a bad thing. So sometimes you got to get your mind off the hockey. So that I think has kept me a bit occupied. And I love, you know, when we're on tour, I love to go do a bit of sightseeing and, you know, get out the hotel, get into a taxi, give the taxi a couple of bucks and just say, take me to all the local spots. I love doing stuff like that just to get out too.
Russ, it's been an absolute pleasure, not just tonight, following your career, you know, chatting about it on a golf course, seeing you in action. Obviously, more action still to come, as you said, still available for RPT, still available for Wanderers. Obviously, that would open up the door to the Belgatex Elite Challenge. So lots of opportunities out there for guys to still see you, still around the hockey field. But it's also just been a pleasure going down memory lane with you, chatting about things. And it was absolutely a pleasure watching you in action, still being probably at the top of your game. And you would have had very few people arguing if you had said, nah, let me carry on for another year. So well done from the Hockey the Podcast team on an incredible career, on being a great servant for South Africa, and ultimately being somebody who advanced the game of hockey despite all the hurdles that were thrown at you.
Thanks, Ty. Yeah, I really appreciate it. And, you know, to all the fans and the Essa community there, yeah, just thank you so much for all the coaches and people that's played a role in my life. I'm still trying to get to everybody out there. Yeah, just a massive thank you to everybody. And trust me, you know, get behind our hockey men and women. There's big things coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Ladies and gents, thank you for tuning in. If you are listening to this before Thursday, the 12th of August, get online, buy yourself a ticket, 50 Rand, and listen. We have an exclusive behind the scenes. It's not going to be recorded and shared. A chat with Gareth Ewing, the coach of the SA Men's Tokyo. He'll also be available for half an hour afterwards for a question and answer. Check it out on all our social media channels. So that's a coaching conversation with Gareth Ewing. We'll even ask him a few questions about being a fines master and if he could tell us what his go-to fine song was. As always, thank you for joining in with Hockey the Podcast. Rossi Peterson, absolutely great servant. It's been a great 90 minutes chat, and we could have carried on going. I'm playing golf with him on Saturday, so we'll carry on the chat on Saturday. You know, go back, check out our Talking Tokyo where we had all the stars join us. Listen to any of the previous episodes. We're closing in on 100. Let's plan something big. I think there will be a good few giveaways available. Thanks for listening. Leave a rating, share it with your friends. It's free of charge, so why not? See you all again soon. Remember, if you have a hockey story, we will tell it. Cheers.